We would like to send out a special thanks to Nutrafol for supporting The Trail Went Cold. It's time to join the thousands of women standing up for their strands. You can grow thicker, healthier hair by going to Nutrafol.com and entering the promo code COLD, and you'll get 20% off. That's Nutrafol.com and enter the promo code COLD to get 20% off. Thank you, and enjoy the episode.
November 28th, 1985, Tarrant County, Texas. The family of 44-year-old Joe Blount gathers together for Thanksgiving dinner in their trailer at the Hilltop Mobile Home Park and find a briefcase on their front doorstep. When the briefcase is opened, a bomb goes off, claiming the lives of Joe, his 15-year-old daughter Angela, and Joe's 18-year-old nephew, Michael Columbus. 14 years later, a suspect named Michael Roy Tony is charged with the bombing and sentenced to death. But it turns out the prosecution withheld evidence supporting his innocence at his trial. Tony's conviction is overturned and he is released from prison in 2009, so no one knows who actually committed the Blount family bombing. After that, the trail went cold.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to our latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host, Robin Warder, and we've got a pretty unique unsolved mystery to cover today. The Blount Family Bombing. That voice you just heard narrating our intro was Brooke Bunch, the latest winner of our most recent Trail Went Cold listener voiceover contest, so thank you very much, Brooke. This is a recurring monthly contest which we've been carrying on for over 3 years, and if you'd like to enter and haven't already done so, I will be providing instructions at the end of the episode. Anyway, the date of this episode's release is one day before American Thanksgiving in 2020, and I recently came to the realization that I had never done a Thanksgiving-themed cold case on this podcast, probably because we celebrate Thanksgiving 1 month earlier here in my home country of Canada. The last article I ever published for listverse.com back in 2016 was titled 10 Unsolved Thanksgiving Mysteries, and since I included this case on that list, I thought it would be interesting to cover. This is the tragic story of a family called the Blounts, who got together for Thanksgiving dinner in 1985 before someone left a briefcase on their front porch, which turned out to be a bomb. When it went off, it claimed the lives of the family's patriarch, Joe Blount, as well as his 14-year-old daughter and 18-year-old nephew. Since the Blounts were just an average working-class family who didn't seem to have any enemies, the crime left everyone baffled, and there was speculation that the bomb may have been intended for someone else. It would be over 14 years before a suspect named Michael Roy Tony was charged and sentenced to death for the murders, but since his trial was fraught with prosecutorial misconduct, Tony's conviction would be overturned and he was released from prison. So unfortunately, this meant the investigation went right back to square one, but since the 35th anniversary of the crime will take place only 3 days after this episode's release, I thought now would be an ideal time to feature it on this podcast. Anyway, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of those sites to help spread the word. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, which may include stickers and thank you cards, early access to episodes, and bonus content. So with all that out of the way, let us now delve in to the Blount family bombing. Thank you. Our story begins in Tarrant County, Texas on Thanksgiving Day in 1985, and one of our victims is 44-year-old Joe Blount, who lives with his wife, Susan Blount, and their two children, 15-year-old Angela and 13-year-old Robert. The couple have been married for 18 years, and in July of that year, they decided to make the move to Texas from Seattle, Washington, in order to help care for Joe's elderly father after he suffered a stroke. In September, the family moved into a rented trailer on lot number 8 of the Hilltop Mobile Home Park, located on the Jacksboro Highway between the towns of Lake Worth and Azle. Joe works as a mechanic, and while he was only able to secure a few temporary gigs after the move to Texas, he has recently been offered a steady full-time position at a new auto transmission shop, which is scheduled to open the Monday after Thanksgiving. In the meantime, the Blounts would hold Thanksgiving dinner at their trailer on November the 28th and be joined by Joe's brother, Carl Ray Blount, who goes by the name Ray. Also attending would be Ray's 18-year-old son, Michael Columbus. Michael had lived with his mother in Seattle and was now attending school in Oklahoma. Michael had been estranged from his father for years, but in an attempt to rekindle the relationship, Ray convinced his son to travel to Texas to spend Thanksgiving with him. After they finished dinner, Ray left at around 5 p.m., but Michael would remain at the trailer to spend the evening with his cousins. At approximately 9 o'clock, while Susan was taking a nap in the master bedroom, Joe decided to drive Robert, Angela, and Michael to a nearby convenience store in order to pick up some beer and snacks. They returned about 20 minutes later, but were surprised to discover that a briefcase was now on their doorstep. When they took the briefcase inside the trailer, Angela decided to open it, but once she flipped the latches, there was a sudden explosion. Susan was awakened by the noise and instantly ran out of the bedroom, where she discovered that the living room was on fire. Susan immediately ran out the back door while her neighbors called for help and started gathering around the trailer. By this point, the flames were so strong that no one was able to enter the trailer to save the rest of the family until the fire department arrived. Susan was put into an ambulance and received medical attention, and it turned out that the force of the blast had blown Robert through the trailer's front door. He now had first and second degree burns, and his clothes and shoes were melted into his skin, but Robert was still alive, so he was immediately rushed to the hospital. While he ultimately survived, Robert would be forced to undergo 2 skin graft operations, which left scars all over his body. Unfortunately, once the flames were put out, the bodies of Joe, Angela, and Michael were discovered inside the trailer. They were burned beyond recognition and had been killed instantly by the explosion. It turned out that the latches on the briefcase had been attached to a pair of mouse traps, which triggered a homemade bomb when the case was opened. The bomb consisted of a glass container filled with gasoline, 2 galvanized metal pipes filled with smokeless gunpowder, a model rocket motor, and a 9-volt battery. Susan claimed that during the 20-minute window when the rest of the family was at the convenience store, she was awoken from her nap by a knock at the front door, but after taking a brief look outside the window and not seeing anything, she went back to sleep in the bedroom. Since Susan managed to escape the trailer unharmed, investigators started looking into her as a possible suspect, but she had no discernible motive to commit the crime. While Susan had taken out life insurance policies on both her husband and daughter, they were only worth $2,000 and $1,000 respectively, and would not have even covered the costs of their burials. After she passed a polygraph, Susan was ruled out as a suspect and moved into an apartment with Robert, though they eventually moved back to Seattle. Investigators also looked into Joe's brother, Ray, who had left the trailer hours before the bombing took place, but there was nothing to suggest that he was involved. The crime left everyone baffled, as the Blounts did not seem to have any known enemies or involvement in criminal activity. However, since there were other residents of the Hilltop Mobile Home Park who did have ties to criminal activity, the authorities began speculating that the bomb may have been left at the wrong trailer. One of these residents was Tim Tortella, who lived in a mobile home behind the Blount residence and was there watching television when the bomb went off. Even though Tortella was a jeweler by trade, he was known to be involved in other illegal activities, which included operating a methamphetamine business from his trailer and selling automatic weapons to drug dealers. Another resident of the park who was known for selling meth from his trailer was Darren Irvin, who lived on lot number 2, 6 spaces away from the Blount residence. In fact, on the afternoon of the bombing, Irvin had a fight with his wife and left the trailer park. But when questioned about the crime, Irvin passed a polygraph, and investigators were unable to find anything to suggest that either he or Tortella were linked to the bombing. Another interesting development would take place in March of 1986, when a man named Douglas Raymond Brown was arrested for selling an explosive device to an undercover agent from the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, aka the ATF. Brown lived in Azle and owned a company that manufactured business machinery, but was being investigated by the ATF because he was reportedly using his business as a front to sell drugs and automatic weapons. Even though the undercover agent had not specifically requested this, the explosive device Brown provided was in the form of a briefcase and very similar to the bomb which was left at the Blount residence. While Brown ultimately wound up receiving a 4-year prison sentence for selling the device, the authorities could not find anything to link him to the Blount bombing and seemed to chalk the whole thing up to a bizarre coincidence. Believe it or not, investigators considered the most promising suspect to be a 15-year-old named Mikey Huff, who was known for being a violent drug user and had a history of criminal offenses such as burglary. Mikey first popped up on the radar when the ATF received some anonymous calls alleging that Mikey had bragged about setting off a bomb. Mikey's stepfather also claimed to have found pieces of a bomb in Mikey's bedroom, and that a pair of Victor brand mousetraps, the same brand of mousetraps which were attached to the briefcase's latches and used to trigger the bomb, had gone missing from their home. It was rumored that Mikey had made advances towards Angela and became angry when she rejected him, which could have given Mikey a potential motive to leave a bomb at her trailer. But once again, the authorities could not find anything to conclusively link him to the crime. The investigation remained at a standstill for a decade, but would receive new life after the infamous Oklahoma City terrorist bombing in April of 1995. This attack compelled the ATF to assemble a new task force to investigate domestic bombings which were still unsolved, so the Blount case was reopened. A grand jury investigation would be launched in order to take a fresh look at Mikey Huff, who was now married and had children, but they never indicted him. However, the case would take an unexpected turn in August of 1997, when the Parker County Sheriff's Office in the town of Weatherford was contacted by a man named Charles Ferris. At the time, Ferris was incarcerated in the Parker County Jail for driving without a valid license, and he crossed paths with a 31-year-old inmate named Michael Roy Tony. According to Ferris, they started a conversation about the Blount family bombing when Tony suddenly confessed to him that he was responsible for the crime. Tony was a career criminal who had no less than 9 felony convictions on his record and was in the county jail awaiting a hearing on a burglary charge. Tony originally hailed from California, but when investigators looked into his history, they discovered that he was living in Tarrant County in November of 1985 when the bombing took place. At the time, Michael had recently started dating his future wife, Kim Tony Ninham, whom he married in March of 1986. The couple wound up divorcing 3 years later, but investigators decided to track Kim down and question her about her ex-husband's alleged confession. At first, Kim completely rejected the idea of Michael being responsible for the bombing, but after doing her own independent research into the case, she contacted the authorities again and shared a brand new story. Not only did Kim suspect that Michael committed the crime, but she now believes she might have been present when he planted the bomb. According to Kim, in 1985, she spent Thanksgiving Day hanging out with Michael and his best friend at the time, Chris Meeks. They all went out together in Michael's Chevrolet Silverado pickup truck before he stopped at a propane shop located on the Jacksboro Highway next to the Hilltop Mobile Home Park. Kim claimed that she saw Michael climb out of the truck with a briefcase in his hand before he walked away, but when he returned a few minutes later, Michael was no longer carrying it. They then left the area and drove to the nearby Fort Worth Nature Center and Refuge to go fishing. Kim maintained that she never heard an explosion and had no idea that a bomb went off that night until she started digging into old newspaper articles about the case and realized that Michael had stopped at the very same trailer park. Kim's story finally gave investigators the evidence they needed to make a case against Michael, so on December the 4th, he would be arrested and indicted on 3 counts of capital murder. The case would be prosecuted by the Tarrant County District Attorney's Office, but before Tony's trial began, they hit a major snag when Charles Ferris, the man who implicated Tony in the first place, suddenly changed his story and claimed that the whole confession was a scam. It turned out that Tony had a reputation for being a quote-unquote jailhouse lawyer who would concoct schemes to help his fellow inmates get out of jail. As an example, there was one prior incident in which Tony convinced an inmate to fake a suicide attempt by hanging himself in order to secure his release. Ferris now said that after they struck up a conversation about the Blount bombing, Tony proposed a scheme in which Ferris would approach the authorities and feed them a false story about Tony confessing to the crime in exchange for an early release from jail. Tony was apparently under the impression that he had been in jail for another crime on the night of the bombing, so he figured that the investigation would immediately eliminate him as a suspect. However, it turned out that Tony was mistaken about the date and was not actually incarcerated when the bombing took place, so the strategy wound up backfiring on him in a huge way. Tony maintained that he never actually heard about the bombing until a short time before his conversation with Ferris. He claimed that he first learned about the case from another inmate named Benny Joe Toole, who had once been a friend of Mikey Huff and was even looked at as a potential suspect at one point before he was ruled out. Indeed, Toole would even testify as a witness for the defense, corroborating Tony's story that he told him about the bombing. Well, even though Charles Ferris recanted his story and would not appear as a witness for the prosecution at Tony's trial, it would still go ahead as planned in May of 1999. Since there was no physical evidence against Tony, the state's entire case would hinge on the testimony of his ex-wife Kim and Tony's former best friend, Chris Meeks. The two men had not seen each other since the spring of 1986, but Meeks backed up Kim's story, claiming that he was with Michael in his pickup truck when they stopped at the propane shop and Michael carried a briefcase into the Hilltop Mobile Home Park. Meeks also testified that a few days prior to the bombing, Tony had opened up the briefcase in his presence and showed him the bomb inside. Tony apparently told him that he needed to, quote-unquote, blow something up, and Meeks would even describe the colors of the bomb's wires. In addition, when Tony returned to the truck without the briefcase in his hand, he allegedly told Meeks that he had, quote-unquote, fulfilled the contract. However, Tony claimed that the testimony from both Meeks and his ex-wife was completely false and that he had never even been to the Hilltop Mobile Home Park. Tony's alibi for Thanksgiving night in 1985 was that he visited Meeks at his home in the town of Keller, where 3 other witnesses, including Meeks' mother, stepfather, and girlfriend, were present. Afterward, Tony said that he met up with Kim at her apartment, which was located about 25 miles away from the trailer park. Tony also debunked the claims that he had been driving a Chevrolet Silverado pickup truck, maintaining that he did not even purchase this truck until December the 13th, 2 weeks after the bombing occurred. While the defense was unable to turn up any official documentation to verify this, they did turn up some other paperwork which poked holes in the prosecution's story. Kim specifically said that she saw Michael take the briefcase out from underneath a toolbox in his truck, but documentation showed that this toolbox was purchased as a birthday present for Michael 1 month later on December the 29th. Kim also testified that when they traveled to the Fort Worth Nature Center and Refuge that night, she saw Michael shoot a beaver with a .22 caliber Ruger model rifle, but ATF gun register records showed that he did not even purchase this rifle until December the 19th. Furthermore, records from the National Weather Service show that the temperature on the evening of November the 28th, 1985, was between 30 to 40 degrees Fahrenheit, making it the coldest date of the month that year, and a very unusual night to go fishing at the Nature Center. The defense attempted to direct suspicion towards Mikey Huff, who was called upon to testify at the trial and denied any involvement in the crime, though he did admit that he had once built a bomb during his youth. While other witnesses testified about having heard Mikey brag about being responsible for the bombing during the 1980s, he claimed this wasn't true. However, Mikey did concede that he enjoyed the attention during this time period because it enhanced his reputation as a quote-unquote tough guy. He testified, quote, "It was a thing with me. I never alluded to being a tough guy. I just let people believe," end quote. Unfortunately for Michael Roy Tony, he was not painted in a very flattering light during his trial, as the prosecution brought up his previous criminal convictions and history of drug usage, and his ex-wife and some other former girlfriends testified that he was abusive. In the end, the jury ultimately believed the prosecution's version of events, and after deliberating for only 4 hours, they found Tony guilty on all 3 counts of capital murder. During the sentencing phase, the state suddenly produced a new eyewitness named Finnis Blankenship, a career criminal who had been a cellmate of Tony's while he was in jail awaiting trial. According to Blankenship, Tony had confessed to him that he was paid $5,000 to commit a drug-related murder with a briefcase bomb, but he wound up leaving the bomb on the doorstep of the wrong trailer. The jury subsequently voted to sentence Tony to death for the crime, and he would be sent to death row at the Allen B. Polunsky Unit in West Livingston. Well, over the next few years, Tony's defense team would find serious issues in the testimony from Chris Meeks and Finnis Blankenship. Meeks was known for being a heavy drinker, who would sometimes drink between 18 to 24 cans of beer per day, and when originally questioned by investigators, he claimed to have no knowledge of the bombing, or any memory at all of Thanksgiving Day in 1985. Even though Meeks ultimately changed his story after further questioning, it turned out that he failed a polygraph prior to the trial, and his testimony on the witness stand proved to be shaky, as he even provided a few details which seemed to contradict the testimony of Kim Tony Ninnem. In 2001, Meeks signed an affidavit for a defense investigator, in which he acknowledged that the events which took place on the night of the bombing may not have happened the way he testified. As for Finnis Blankenship, at the time of the trial, he happened to be facing 2 counts of indecency with a child, which were subsequently dropped in exchange for his testimony during the sentencing phase. He eventually admitted that the story about having heard Tony confess to the bombing was a complete lie. The controversy surrounding Tony's conviction attracted the attention of the Texas Innocence Network at the University of Houston, who agreed to take on his case. While Tony's initial appeal, as well as his first state law petition for a writ of habeas corpus, were denied, his second habeas petition was a lot more successful after his defense team uncovered evidence of prosecutorial misconduct. It turned out that the Tarrant County District Attorney's Office had withheld 14 documents from the defense containing potentially exculpatory evidence, as they showcased a number of credibility issues with the testimony of Kim Tony Ninnem and Chris Meeks. The documents suggested that investigators and prosecutors had fed them both information about the crime and kept pressuring them to revise their stories until they fit the prosecution's narrative. For example, one document showed that Kim had originally stated she did not recall her ex-husband carrying a briefcase on the night of the bombing, but after the ATF called in a cognitive interviewing technique specialist to perform hypnosis on Kim, she suddenly changed her story and remembered seeing a briefcase. Another key issue, which was not shared with the defense, is that Kim had been exposed to toxic chemicals while serving in the military during the Gulf War, which caused her to suffer from memory loss and potentially made her suggestible to remembering events which never actually happened. These allegations of prosecutorial misconduct were presented to the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals, and on December the 17th, 2008, they ruled that Tony's constitutional rights had been violated and overturned his conviction. Tony was subsequently taken off death row and transferred to the Tarrant County Jail, while the Tarrant County District Attorney's Office withdrew from the case and turned it over to the Office of the Attorney General for the state of Texas. After several months of legal wrangling, the state finally announced on September the 2nd, 2009, that they were dropping all charges against Tony, and he was finally released from custody. When asked if the investigation would now pursue other suspects, a spokesman for the Attorney General stated, quote, "Evidence will dictate the direction of the case and possible suspects," end quote. Well, in a tragic postscript to this story, Michael Roy Tony would not get to enjoy his newfound freedom for very long. On the foggy morning of October the 3rd, just 1 month after his release, Tony was driving his pickup truck on a remote road in Cherokee County when he suddenly veered off the road and overturned. Since Tony was not wearing his seatbelt, he was ejected from the truck and wound up losing his life at the age of 43. To date, no one else has ever been charged with the murders of Joe Blount, Angela Blount, and Michael Columbus, so the truth about who was actually responsible for the Blount family bombings remains unknown. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. But before we continue, we would like to take a moment to thank our sponsor, Nutrafol, as we are very excited that they are supporting The Trail Went Cold. If there's one situation in which you don't want to utter the phrase, the trail went cold, it's hair growth. 30 million women are impacted by weakened or thinning hair, but if you're among them, you need to know that you're not alone, and there is a solution out there that will deliver results, as thousands of women have taken back control of their hair with Nutrafol. Many users have raved that the supplement has not only transformed their hair, but managed to restore their confidence as well. Nutrafol offers two targeted formulas for women that are clinically shown to improve hair growth and thickness through all stages of life, and there is less shedding as well. Healthier hair growth does take time, but you will begin to experience thicker, stronger, faster-growing hair within 3 to 6 months. There was a clinical study where 86% of women reported having improved hair growth after 6 months. As a result, more than 1,500 top doctors recommend Nutrafol as an effective and high-quality solution for healthier hair. I have this female friend who told me she loves Nutrafol because there was a time when she was a bit sensitive about her thinning hair, but Nutrafol did wonders for her, leading to improved hair growth. It supports healthy hair growth from within by targeting the 5 root causes of thinning: stress, hormones, environment, nutrition, and metabolism. Now she uses Nutrafol all the time, and so should you. When you subscribe, you'll receive automatic monthly deliveries so you never miss a dose. You can grow thicker, healthier hair and support our show by going to Nutrafol.com and using our promo code, and new customers will get 20% off. This is their best offer available anywhere, plus free shipping on every order. Get 20% off at Nutrafol.com, spelling Nutrafol.com, and use the promo code COLD. That's Nutrafol.com, and the promo code is COLD. Thank you, and enjoy the rest of the episode. Anyway, cold cases involving wrongful convictions are always extra heartbreaking, because not only does an innocent person serve time in prison for a crime they did not commit, but the experience also puts the victim's family members through the emotional wringer. I can't imagine how difficult it must be to think you have found closure and justice for your loved one, but then find out that the wrong person was convicted for the crime, so you're now going to have to go right back to square one. I'm sure it must be especially difficult for Susan and Robert Blount, because they were actually present when the bomb that killed their family went off, and Robert is lucky to have survived. However, while no one deserves to be convicted of a crime they did not commit, particularly if it involves them being sent to death row, what makes this story unique is that, well, Michael Roy Tony really deserves a lot of the blame for putting himself in that position. There are many wrongful conviction cases which come about because of a false story from a jailhouse informant, but this is the only one I can think of where the accused flat out told the informant to implicate them in the crime. I mean, yes, it is ultimately the responsibility of the investigators to perform due diligence and weed out false confessions, but if Tony had not done this, he probably never would have popped up on the radar as a suspect. Like I mentioned earlier, he seemed to be under the mistaken impression that he was in jail on the night of the bombing and would have had an airtight alibi to eliminate him as a suspect, but I think he underestimated the desperation of the investigators to finally solve this thing. They had spent the past decade chasing down a number of different leads and potential suspects which never panned out, so once they got word that someone had allegedly confessed to the crime, they totally ran with it. I'm definitely not saying that Michael Roy Tony was a good guy, as he had an extensive history of criminal activity and abusing his spouses, but it's totally inexcusable that the state fabricated and withheld evidence, especially since it could have led to an innocent man being executed. I think it speaks volumes that the prosecution wouldn't even put Charles Ferris, the informant who originally implicated Tony, on the stand during the trial. And I find it particularly egregious that they found this other jailhouse snitch, Finnis Blankenship, and got him to testify about a bogus confession during Tony's sentencing phase after he was already found guilty. They probably figured that if Blankenship shared this story during the trial, the defense would have torn him apart, but they likely hoped his additional last-minute testimony might sway the jury into sentencing Tony to death, because if he was executed, he would cease to be anyone's problem. The big issue with the prosecution's case is that there was literally no other evidence against Tony besides the testimony of Kim Tony Ninham and Chris Meeks, who both proved to be very unreliable eyewitnesses. I'm not sure if either of them was intentionally lying, as they may have legitimately believed the stories they shared, but one of them had a history of memory loss due to exposure from toxic chemicals, and the other seemed to be a functional alcoholic, so they both had to be fed information and have their statements altered and manipulated in order to craft a coherent narrative which implicated Tony. But even so, there were still a ton of holes in their stories, such as the fact that they described Tony having a truck, rifle, and toolbox, which he would not have even owned at the time the bombing took place. There's also never been anything to suggest that Tony even knew the Blount family, and the potential motive which has been presented is that Tony was hired to kill someone else, but mistakenly left the bomb at the wrong location. While I don't believe Tony was a model citizen, I do have to feel some sympathy for the fact that he was killed in a truck crash only 1 month after he was released from jail. I've seen a few sources speculate online that perhaps Tony was murdered as retribution by people who still believed he was guilty of the bombing, but I've seen no evidence to indicate that this was anything more than an accident. Since this wasn't a case that hinged on anything conclusive, like DNA evidence, I guess you can't say that Tony was 100% exonerated, as his conviction was overturned because of prosecutorial misconduct, and the state still technically had the option to bring him to trial again if new evidence ever surfaced. I know that when Tony's conviction was overturned, Susan Blount still publicly expressed her belief that he was guilty, so perhaps she feels that justice was ultimately served when Tony was killed in the truck crash. Indeed, Tony's untimely death does give the authorities a convenient excuse not to perform any further investigation into this case, but the problem is that this only ensures that the real perpetrator continues to get away with it. Anyway, given the complete lack of evidence against him, I think we can safely rule out Michael Roy Tony as being the guilty party, but if it wasn't him, who was responsible for this crime, and what could their motive have been? The thing that really sticks out about this crime is the unusual manner in which it was carried out. A briefcase rigged with a bomb is the type of weapon you would expect to find in a terrorist attack against a high-profile target, but why would someone decide to use it to murder a working-class family living in a trailer park in Texas? In addition, the Blounts had only moved to Texas from Washington State 4 months earlier and had only been living in the Hilltop Mobile Home Park for just over 2 months. What kind of enemies could this family have made during their short time there? Yes, it sounds like there was a lot of drug activity taking place in Tarrant County during this time period, but no one has ever found any evidence to suggest the Blounts were involved in that. But since it sounds like some of their neighbors were flat out selling methamphetamine from their trailers, the idea of the bomb being left on the wrong doorstep and the Blounts being the victims of mistaken identity is not that implausible. It's interesting how most of the family just happened to be out at a convenience store when the briefcase was dropped off. Susan has always claimed that she heard a knock on the front door while everyone else was away, but didn't see anyone when she looked out the window, which is why she decided to go back to bed. However, if Susan had opened the door, found the briefcase, and decided to open it before her family returned, she would have been the only casualty. This means that if Joe or any of the other victims were the intended target, the perpetrator got very lucky that the briefcase remained on the doorstep until they got back. Given the circumstances, you can see why investigators would have looked at Susan as a possible suspect, but she didn't seem to have any motive for this crime. And I also have a hard time believing that she would elect to stay inside the bedroom when the bomb went off, because there would still be a risk of getting killed in the blast or being unable to escape the trailer when it caught on fire. The incident clearly had a traumatic effect on Susan and Robert, who not only had permanent scars on his body from surviving the blast, but was plagued by nightmares following his release from the hospital. In fact, shortly before Christmas that year, there was an incident where Susan and Robert returned home to discover a box resting outside the front door of their new apartment. This frightened them so much that they decided to call the police, but it turned out the box contained nothing more than fudge, which had been sent to them from their church. While there's no indication that he was ever considered a serious suspect, I've always wanted to hear more about Joe Blount's brother, Ray. By all accounts, Susan did not like Ray at all, but was willing to allow him to attend Thanksgiving dinner because he was attempting to reconnect with his estranged son, Michael Columbus. I don't know all that much about Ray and Michael's relationship, but what adds an extra element of tragedy to this story is that Michael actually called his mother after dinner to tell her how happy he was that things were going well with his father, only for Michael to wind up dead within hours. It's not entirely clear to me why Ray had to leave the trailer at 5 p.m., and I'm sure it might have looked convenient that he happened to be away before the bomb went off, but I'm guessing that investigators verified his whereabouts and determined that he could not have been responsible for what happened. But I can only imagine how Ray must have felt, losing his son, and knowing that he likely would have been killed as well if he had stayed there for a couple more hours. Anyway, it sounds like we have at least two other individuals who were living in the Hilltop Mobile Home Park who were involved in criminal activity, Darren Irvin and Tim Tortella. While it doesn't sound like there was much to suggest that either of them might have been the perpetrator, it's certainly possible they were the intended targets. Given that they were both involved in dealing meth out of their trailers, I'm sure some of you might be having Breaking Bad flashbacks, especially since there's a major scene in that show where Walter White disposes of one of his rivals with a homemade bomb. There isn't much information out there about Irvin, but he was absent from the trailer park that day after getting into a fight with his wife. Apparently, when Irvin stormed out of there, he grabbed a couple of pistols and a box of bullets, but wound up spilling a bunch of them on the ground. So by the time police arrived, there were bullets lying all over the front yard, and since the trailer had been ransacked during the fight between the Irvins, the scene instantly aroused suspicion. But Irvin claimed that his drug dealing operation was pretty small, and that he only had one contact from Arkansas whom he did serious business with. Since Irvin didn't owe any money to this person at that time, he never believed that anyone would have had a motive to kill him. Indeed, while Irvin's trailer was six spaces down from the Blount residence, Tim Tortella lived directly behind them, so the idea of someone mistaking the Blount's trailer for Tortella's is a bit more plausible. And since Tortella also apparently sold automatic weapons to drug dealers, you can see why he might have been a more compelling target. It's interesting to read the original newspaper articles about this case, because Tortella is actually interviewed in some of them, mentioning that he was inside his mobile home watching television with his brother when the explosion caused their whole residence to shake. When Tortella and his brother ran to the scene, they also helped tend to Robert before the paramedics arrived, and even tried to enter the trailer to rescue the rest of the family, but the smoke and the flames were just too strong. While Irvin has expressed his skepticism over the bomb being intended for him, Tortella actually thinks that possibility might be true, and has even expressed remorse about it. Around the time of Tony's trial, Tortella wrote in a letter, quote, "For 14 years, I felt that it was my fault that those three people died. There is a possibility that if I wasn't doing what I was doing back then, they would still be alive," end quote. In addition, it's also been reported that Tortella was carrying on an affair with a married woman at that time, opening up the possibility that the motive for the bombing was personal and had nothing to do with his criminal activities. Well, if Tortella genuinely believed he was the real target, I'd like to think he provided the authorities with the names of any promising suspects who might have had a motive to harm him. Otherwise, it sounds like the investigation into that angle hit a dead end. So now we're going to talk about some other potential suspects, including Douglas Raymond Brown, who was arrested for attempting to sell a briefcase bomb to an undercover ATF agent only 4 months after the crime. Brown lived in Azle, which is only a couple miles away from the trailer park, and given how unique these types of explosive devices are, what are the odds that two of them would show up within months of each other in the same county in Texas and not be connected in some way? During my research, it was tough to get a read on how the authorities viewed Brown, as none of the sources I could find confirmed that he was officially ruled out as a suspect, but he apparently did pass a polygraph, and it seems like the authorities lean towards the whole thing being an astonishing coincidence. As far as I can tell, no real connection was ever found between Brown and the Blount family, so I'm not sure what motive he would have had to murder them. But I do find it interesting that the undercover ATF agent Brown dealt with had only asked him for an explosive device, but never specifically requested that it be delivered in the form of a briefcase bomb. This suggests that Brown had already manufactured devices like that before, so you have to wonder if he might have unknowingly provided one to the person who did commit the murders. Of course, I'd like to think that investigators already looked into that angle and came up empty, but really, how many briefcase bombs were floating around in Tarrant County during that time period? So it seems like the most promising suspect in the investigation was Mikey Huff, and that his alleged motive for the crime was getting revenge on Angela for spurning his advances. It does sound like Mikey was a pretty troubled kid, and there is some circumstantial evidence to suggest he could have been responsible for this, such as the fact that two mouse traps matching the traps used to rig the bomb supposedly went missing from his home. But we are talking about a 15-year-old, and while people that young are capable of inflicting horrific acts of violence, assembling together a bomb which goes off when you open a briefcase does seem pretty sophisticated. I mean, these days, a 15-year-old could probably figure out how to construct a device like that after doing enough research on the internet, but this was back in 1985. And I have to admit that I rolled my eyes pretty hard when I found out that one of Michael Roy Tony's defense attorneys attempted to point the finger at Mikey as an alternate suspect at the trial, and flat out stated that Mikey worshipped Satan. Indeed, Mikey did apparently brag about being a Satan worshipper during his teen years, which is one of the reasons many people were afraid of him, but I'm not going to take that as evidence that he was responsible for the bombing. I'm sure you all know that the 1980s was the height of satanic panic. I've talked about that topic on a number of previous podcast episodes, so I have to wonder if this panic made people think that Mikey was more capable of evil than he really was. There were witnesses who testified at the trial that they had heard Mikey openly brag about the bombing, but his explanation was that he didn't so much brag, but rather did nothing to quell the gossip and got off on the idea that it was helping him develop a reputation. During his testimony, he admitted that he was once arrested for burglary and sent to a juvenile corrections facility by the Texas Youth Commission, and this only caused the rumors to escalate because people mistakenly assumed he had been arrested for the bombing. Well, I don't know many specific details about Mikey Huff's criminal history, but I am willing to believe that a lot of the stuff which made people think he was guilty may have simply been the result of him acting like an edgy teenager. When the ATF task force reopened this case in the mid-1990s, they also offered a $25,000 reward for information, which brought in a lot of tips from people who advised them to take a second look at Mikey Huff. But how many of these tips were based on nothing more than hearsay and rumors? It doesn't sound like the investigation slacked off when it came to exploring Mikey as a possible suspect, and they even attempted to take the case to a grand jury, but in the end, there was just not enough evidence to implicate him. I'm not saying I completely 100% rule out Mikey as a suspect, but could a 15-year-old really have been capable of getting away with something like this for so long? The thing with Mikey is that while the theory about him planting the bomb as revenge against Angela does seem a bit over the top, it is the only real motive which has ever been presented for why someone would deliberately target the Blount family. Most of the other theories seem to be based on them being the unfortunate victims of mistaken identity, which would make the crime a lot more difficult to solve. I have done a couple of other podcast episodes on unsolved murders, such as Doug Johnston, Matt Flores, and Mary Morris, where it's been theorized that a botched contract hit took place and the perpetrator killed the wrong person. But those victims were targeted individually, whereas this particular crime may have involved leaving the bomb on the doorstep of the wrong residence at a trailer park, which is a much easier mistake to make. Hell, since the Blounts had only lived there for 2 months, perhaps the intended target was the previous occupant of the trailer located on lot number 8, though I'm sure the authorities probably looked into that angle. I know that investigators delved into the backgrounds of the other residents of that trailer park and came up with a couple of promising candidates who may have been the real target, but here's one more alternate theory. What if the bomb was not only left at the wrong trailer, but the wrong trailer park? I don't know how many other trailer parks were located in that particular section of Texas at that time, but if the real target was not actually a resident of the Hilltop Mobile Home Park, perhaps that's why the authorities have been unable to put two and two together. However, it's also possible that a lot of people have a pretty good idea who did this bombing, but there's just not enough evidence to implicate them. While he was still incarcerated on death row, Michael Roy Tony wrote a statement, which was published in a magazine called Justice Denied, and it contained this very interesting passage. Quote, "Since the trial, my family and I have received numerous phone calls and letters from people saying they know I'm innocent because they know who did the bombing and why it was done. I believe the fact that no one could ever determine the motive is the reason they couldn't solve the crime. I've been in contact with these people who wrote and called my family. They have told me what the motive was, who did it, and why the motive was never determined. Yes, I have learned who the real murderers are, but they will remain free to commit more murders unless the investigation is reopened. No one will listen to me because the case has been closed." End quote. Tony then went on to mention that the people who committed the crime live in the Fort Worth area, and I find it interesting how he specifically used the word people to imply there was more than one person involved. Now, as far as I can tell, Tony never publicly revealed the identities of these people who were supposedly implicated in the bombing. If he had not been killed in the truck crash only 1 month after his release, perhaps Tony might have been able to spread awareness about the real perpetrators. But I think his death gave the authorities a convenient out, because they could just keep saying that Tony was the right man all along and have no obligation to reopen the investigation. And that's a real shame, because there are 3 deceased victims out there who have still never received justice. However, if a number of people really did contact Tony and his family about the identities of the real killers, then this implies there are still quite a few individuals who know the truth and could break the case wide open. So if you happen to have any information about the Blount family bombing, please contact the appropriate authorities. Anyway, another special thanks to Brooke Bunch for narrating the opening of this episode. If you've already entered our listener voiceover contest before, you're automatically eligible for our next random drawing, so you don't have to do anything. But if you would like to enter and haven't done so yet, all you have to do is send me an email under the subject line, Trail Went Cold Contest, naming the one unsolved cold case you would most like to see covered on this podcast. So once again, send me an email under the subject line, Trail Went Cold Contest, to robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Now the reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. We produced a bunch of exclusive bonus episodes for our patrons in tiers 2 and 3, and this past month, I released an episode in which I discussed and analyzed the famous Unsolved Mysteries Halloween special, which aired on television in October of 1988 and featured four very memorable segments about ghosts. And for our patrons in Tier 3, I've also recorded another new audio commentary track, which can be played over a classic episode of Unsolved Mysteries. I'd also like to give a shout out to our most recent listeners who have signed up with us on Patreon this week, and they are Agnesia M and Tim F. Thank you so much for your support. I'd also like to make a special announcement that next year, provided that it becomes safe to travel again, The Trail Went Cold is going to be appearing on Podcast Row at two separate CrimeCon events. Regular CrimeCon at the Fairmont Hotel in Austin, Texas from June 4th until the 6th, and the very first CrimeCon UK, which will be taking place at the Leonardo Royal Hotel and Spa in London the following weekend on June 12th and 13th. If you would like to purchase tickets to either event, we have a special promo code to get yourself a 10% discount, and it applies to both the Austin and London events. So to receive 10% off, either visit crimecon.com or crimecon.co.uk and enter the promo code COLD21. That's COLD21. And before I bring this episode to a close, I'd like to play a promo for a new podcast, which is also going to be appearing at CrimeCon UK next year, and covers a case you might be familiar with from Unsolved Mysteries. Here's The Shattered Window.
The murder of Jacqueline DeWallaby is a tragedy that has puzzled and polarized the minds of those who know it. Over the past 6 months, we've extensively investigated this case, trawling through files, trial transcripts, and archives, and have been conducting interviews with the people who've lived through it.
It was a sensational, startling fact that a 7-year-old little girl had shown up missing from a suburban home.
Something like that happening would have never crossed our parents' minds.
The notion that a stranger can slip into a child's bedroom in the middle of the night, completely undetected, is surely a notion that every single parent on this earth fears. But what's even more lamentable is knowing that a child killer is roaming the street. And even more chilling, they could be someone you know.
Hosted by Emily G. Thompson and Eileen McFarlane, this is The Shattered Window.
In addition, I also wanted to provide another reminder that I hold live streaming sessions on a platform called Get Vocal. Every Thursday night from 7 until 8 p.m. Eastern Time, I host what is essentially an after-show for each week's podcast episode, where I have an interactive discussion about the featured case from said episode, and answer questions and address comments from listeners. I always include a link to these sessions in our show notes of every episode, so be sure to check there for more information, or visit getvocal.com. That's GETVOKL.com. I also just wanted to give another shout out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum, and the Unresolved Mystery subreddit. I need to provide a big thanks to McGill Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the eerie music here on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, or Spotify. Anyway, I'd like to close things off by wishing all of our American listeners a safe and happy Thanksgiving this week, and once again, join us next Wednesday for another brand new episode of The Trail Went Cold. Thank you.